generally in all the discussions in the different commentaries in the Mefarshim about the Egel, the sin of the Egel, you know, the question is, of course, how could this come about? Why? I mean, the Jews were, if we want to just put it in a historical time reference, they came out of Egypt Pesach. They received the Torah Shavuos. They sinned with the Egel Shavuos or Betamos. Okay? That would be the timeline. It means all this happened in a short period of several months. The question, how could Jews in such a short period of time go through so much? Sin with the Egel. They came out in Nisan, equivalent of, let's say, April, from Egypt. They received the Torah in Shavuos, which is 7 weeks later, in Sivan, end of May, let's say. And by July, they were already worshipping the Egel. So it's from like April to July. They left Egypt, they received the Torah, they're already worshipping the Egel. It wasn't mass amnesia. They received the Torah on Har Sinai, and then less than 6 weeks after that, a month and a half after receiving the Torah on Har Sinai, exactly a month and a half later, they're already sinning with the Egel. So they forgot that they heard God speak. They forgot the miracles. They forgot Exodus. They forgot the sea splitting. Can't be. They knew that God took them out of Egypt. The splitting of the sea, the miracles, the man, revelation at Har Sinai, God's voice. 6 weeks later, they're already sinning. They're already worshiping the Egel, the idol. The question is how and why this occurred. Most Mefarshim try to understand what went on in terms of how they perceived the Egel to be. And therefore there's all kinds of philosophical or mystical discussion as to what the Egel was all about. And I'm not going to go with that right now. The Ramban, the classical Mefarshim, explain what really went through their minds, why they began to worship the Egel. What's interesting though in general is that all ideologies are based on philosophy as well as psychology. There's the philosophy of the ideology, but there's also the psychology of how people, why they became the way they became. And therefore when you ask a question like why, or why the Egel, you could approach it philosophically, you could approach it psychologically. We're going to use the psychological approach and the psychological profile because of how that relates to us nowadays as well. Because those psychological forces that brought about an Egel, even if nowadays the philosophical forces aren't there, but the psychological forces could still be there, let's understand the Egel from a psychological perspective. When I say psychology, though, I don't mean you go to modern psychologists and you hear from the shrinks all their psychobabble nonsense and all of the therapeutic things and all this kind of stuff. I'm not talking about modern psychobabble therapy. I'm talking about Musar. Because essentially Musar is psychology. It's the understanding of what makes people work and the way they work, and that's what Musar was about. One of the great Bali Musar was Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, Mashgiach and Mir Yeshiva, passed away in our generation not that long ago. And this is also one of his classical pieces that gives a very valuable insight in understanding what went on by the Egel, and that could be applied to us nowadays as well. So let's first take a look at the Pesukim. Vayar ha'om pasuk aleph. The people saw ki vo sheish Moshe lo redes min har, that Moshe delayed or tarried or was delayed, and they waited for him and he didn't come down. and Moshe seemed to have been delayed in coming down from the har. Vayikoil ho'omal Aaron, the people congregated around Aaron, and they asked him, Vayomel kuma say lonu Elohim asher yechul ufaneinu, make for us an Elohim. I mean, the word Elohim is not really only translated as God. It has various meanings. And the word Elohim is not the same as Hashem, which is God, but rather some sort of a symbolic either leader or force or intermediary force. Asher Yechul, for them, that will guide us. Like Moshe was our guide. So they're looking more for a guide than a God. Because we don't know what happened to Moshe. He just disappeared. He's gone. So you could immediately see that they weren't just looking for a deity to worship. They were looking for someone to guide them. They were looking for a replacement for Moshe. So it's not quite idol worship the way we think of idol worship, whereby you're looking for a deity, a divinity, or a representation of divinity. They're actually looking for a guide, a replacement for Moshe. So what they were looking for was more a replacement of Moshe than a replacement of Hashem. Vayomer aleihem Aaron porku nizmei hazav. He tries to delay things a little bit, take off the gold, silver, take them from the gold from your children, your wives. They do that, and they place it in the fire, and somehow or other an eagle emerges. This becomes now the representation of your leadership, at least. So Rashi elaborates as to why Moshe delayed. Moshe didn't exactly delay, they just miscalculated. They expected him to come back a certain time, and he didn't. But Rashi in the middle also points out that because of this seeming delay of Moshe, that's where the Satan got his little entry. That's where he was able to enter and fool the people. In the words of Rashi, I'm going to skip the first parts of Rashi because I don't want to go through all, the technical time issues here. But on Shivos Betamuz, it's in the second column of Rashi. It's around the midpoint of Rashi in that column. Kiboshesh Moshe. In the middle of that Rashi, Bo Hasotan. The Sotan came. The Irve Vesa'olam. And mixed up and confused the world to them. The Herod was choishech vafela, and he made things dark and cloudy to them. The irvuvia, and confused, mixed up. Loimar, he made the Jews think, vadai meis Moshe. Moshe must have died. Surely Moshe died. The kachbo irvuvia lo'olam, that's why the world seems so dark, depressed, why the world seems so confused and mixed up and cloudy and confused. Omar Lohem, so the Satan said to the Jews, Mace Moshe. Moshe's time is up and he didn't return. He's obviously dead. So Moshe actually came down the next morning. He didn't come down the day that they expected that day. He came down the next day. But that critical difference of that one day was enough for them to begin the worship of the eagle. Because the following morning is when they began the worship of the eagle. That's when Moshe Rabbeinu showed up. So you see what happens if you come late. You really cause confusion. The people that are waiting. Not the guy that came, he wasn't confused, Moshe wasn't the problem. But those that come in the middle, when everybody's like patiently waiting for them, you sow confusion in the minds of everybody else that's waiting. This is Rashi. Rashi, in the next Rashi, says, Kizem Moshe Ho'ish. When they said, this Moshe, And again, we've always had the word Zeh referring to something which they point at. Zeh Keli Vavdehu, this is my God, they pointed to. Zeh Moshe means this man Moshe. It seemed that the Sotan confused them even more. K'min Dmus Moshe Her Elohim HaSotan. The Sotan showed them some sort of an image that appeared to them similar to Moshe. Shenois Moshe Ba'avir Ruki HaShemayim, carried aloft by angels in a coffin, if you will. So, that's the image that they saw. In other words, they somehow perceived and thought that Moshe is dead. They were convinced Moshe is dead. Therefore, they wanted a replacement. And the replacement was the eagle. So, as I said, there are two ways of approaching something like the eagle. Trying to understand it philosophically, mystically, what it was they had in mind, or trying to understand psychologically what causes people to fall into this kind of a trap, into this pitfall. Says Reb Chaim Shmulev, it's a very beautiful insight here. Let's read inside now. It says, Soru maher min aderech asher tzivisim osavu lohem egel masecha. This, on top of the page, of the side that has the piece from Reb Chaim Shmulev, you're probably on the wrong side, Jerry. Yeah. This, what Reb Chaim Shmulev is bothered with, is the following question. He's bothered with the following question. If you look again on page 213, on Pasuk Zion, God informs Moshe that the people are sinning with the eagle. Vaydabar Hashem al Moshe lech reid, go down. Kishi ches amcha, the people have become corrupted. Asher leisav et Yisrael, your nation has corrupted. Pasuk Ches. Soru maher min aderech. They have deviated very quickly from the path. Asher tzivisim, that I commanded them. Only 6 weeks ago I told them, don't make graven images. They heard the Ten Commandments directly from God. Don't make graven images. They heard that directly from Hashem. Less than 6 weeks, a month and a half before, God tells them, no graven images. And in a month and a half, they're violating one of the worst and most serious sins in Judaism, to make graven images. Soru maher, they have rapidly, quickly deviated min aderech, from the path asher tzivisim, that I commanded them. Osulam egel masecha, they made for themselves a molten image of a calf. Vayishtachavulo, they bowed down to it and they sacrificed to it and they proclaimed it to be their God, their Elohim, whatever you want to refer to it as. Well, they violated the Ten Commandments in a month and a half. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz asks the following question, which produces an insight. And that is that Hashem is talking about the Jews sinning very rapidly, declining and deviating to the point of Avodah Zarah very, very quickly. Now how does that work, is what's bothering him. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, one would think, lo harei chet Avodah Zarah karei shar chatoim. The sin of idolatry is generally different than other sins. Shekein afilu tzadik ol likosh l'chashu sholom v'cheid kolshu. Because we know that anybody is capable of stumbling and sinning. That's something that anyone is capable of. Yet, v'ilu b'avon avodah zarah, but something as serious as avodah zarah, e'efshu l'tzadik, you can't imagine a righteous person, or for that matter, if you know Stamadam Kosher, any regular good Jew, the Koshul Vasachas to stumble into. Other sins, temptation, causes a person to stumble and sin. But to go from belief in God to idol worship, no regular Jew stumbles and falls so rapidly and in one shot goes from a state of belief to non-belief or disbelief or belief in Avodah Zarah. It's not something that a person normally happens in one shot. In fact, he quotes here from the Gemara Shabbos of Kufayim days, Kach Nasa Shal Yetzer Hara. The pattern of the Yetzer Hara, the Yetzer Hara's system of causing people to sin, is one of gradual, incremental buildup. Gradual. Hayyim Oimer Lo Yasei Kach, the Gemara Shabbos says, today the Yetzer Hara gets you to deviate a little bit. Once you're accustomed to that, Mochar Omer Lo Yasei Kach, tomorrow he gets to go a little bit further, a little bit more. Ad Shoyim Lo Lech Avod Avod Azor, until finally he gets to idol worship. So idol worship doesn't come with one fell swoop. It comes incrementally, gradually. It's a buildup of sin after sin, stumbling after stumbling, falling after falling, until you finally fall all the way and you stumble and you worship Avodah Zarah. That, says the Gemara on Shabbos, is the pattern and the system that the Yetzer Hara employs to get people to sin in a more serious way, by getting them to sin slightly. And we see that if you go into all the deviationist movements, all the deviationist movements, you take what's in the conservative movement, go back to the Reform movement. The Reform movement in the 1800s, bring in a little bit of organs, have a guy play the organ on Shabbos, not even a Jew, move the bima, change the language of the sermon, gradually. There were extreme reformers even then, but they didn't really stand much of a chance of getting everyone to go like that. Yet we do find that in one generation, Frankfurt, Germany, went from a state of all the Jews being God-fearing Jews to the overwhelming majority becoming reformers. A decline of one generation, because that's the way the Yetzer Hara gets you, a little bit at a time. It wasn't that long ago, in the 1950s, that the conservative movement, in order to promote Shmir Shabbos, and in order to promote Jews staying in the fold, permitted driving to shul on Shabbos. Only to shul, nowhere else. That was the conservative movement's, that was their psak. And as Rabbi Osman said over in the name of Rabbi Chaim Stein, Chaim Stein, Shlita Rosh Shiva in Telz, he was on an airplane with Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was a Shomer Shabbos, was a Shomer Torah Mitzvah, a Jew that kept the Torah and the Mitzvahs, but he was one of the leading lights of the conservative movement in the JTS. He was one of their stars. And Chaim Stein asked him, like, how he could allow this kind of flagrant violation of Shabbos. And he says his goal is to get people to shul. And what his plans are is to ultimately hire a bus driven by a guy that's going to pick up the Jews from their homes, drive them to shul on Shabbos, and let them off and drive them home. And it's not a real violation of Shabbos. It's only a goyish driver. Yes, it's rabbinically forbidden to have a guy do something for you, but riding a bus is not a real violation of Shabbos. If you go on a subway, you're not violating Shabbos. Someone else is doing the driving. Someone else is doing it. It's merely a shvus. It's a rabbinic violation of telling a guy to do something. But we know that certain times you're allowed to tell a guy to do certain things. Shuls have goyim that work. The Shabbos guy works in a shul, and he turns on and off lights for the shul. And it's considered permissible because something that you do for a large body of people, and you're doing it for mitzvah purposes, we sometimes relax the laws of shvus, of amir al-akmo, telling a guy what to do. In fact, the original assumption was that the reason why they allowed goyish, why they allowed music in the shuls, in the temples, on Shabbos, is based on the same premise, that it's a guy that's doing it, therefore it's only a shvus. Playing musical instruments in those days was not electronic. and therefore there's no Torah violation in playing music to begin with, because playing a guitar or a piano on Shabbos is not a Torah violation. It's only a rabbinic violation. And telling a guy to do it is certainly much less. It's only a rabbinic violation piled on another one. And you're doing it for the sake of mitzvah, to enhance the beauty of the services. So to do a rabbinic violation that's a mild one for the benefit of a mitzvah is not so terrible. To allow a guy to pick up Jews on a bus and drive them to shul on Shabbos for the mitzvah that's going to keep the Jews in the fold, it's not the worst thing. But how rapid was the decline after that? There's almost no conservative Jew nowadays that's even aware of the vestige of what the allowance of driving on Shabbos was all about. Certainly no one ever allowed the conservative movement turning lights on and off. They didn't allow them to go to the beach, they didn't allow them to go to the mall, they didn't allow them to go shopping, they didn't allow them to watch television, answer telephones. That wasn't, well, telephone maybe is a little different, but they certainly didn't allow the wholesale desecration of Shabbos. Yet the decline is so overwhelmingly complete that, even read it just recently in an article, that about the only ones, actually it was a letter to the Jewish Week, I think about a week ago, referring to the conservative movement, saying that only the clergy keep Shabbos or Kashrus, if that. I don't know how much the clergy does, but you'll only find it amongst the conservative clergy that they're obeying Shabbos and keeping Kashrus. The rank and file, the lay body of the conservative people, 95 to 100% are in wholesale desecration of Shabbos and violation of Kashrus, at least some of the time. Complete decline. From making this small little deviation to total Shabbos desecration, what a rapid decline. So the Yetzer Hara finds its way to worm in step by step. But you don't suddenly go from belief in God to Avodah Zarah. So how did that happen over here? The Idah Gisa, although it says in the Gemara Shabbos that the Yetzer Hara's approach to Avodah Zarah is an incremental one, regarding the eagle, God says to Moshe, look how rapidly they went into idol worship. Again, one approach to understanding all this is to understand the philosophy and the mystical things behind the eagle. I'm not going there. We're talking about the generation that came out from Egypt, people that witnessed the greatest things. And suddenly, from the highest heights, from the rooftops, to the depths of the pit of the sin of the eagle. Tzorach lahavin, we have to understand what method did the Yetzer Hara employ to get Jews to do that. So let's leave the philosophy out of it, because as we pointed out many times, philosophy is merely an after-the-fact rationalization of what it is the person wants to do anyway. All philosophy is justification. People will create ideologies and philosophies to justify and rationalize their behavior. So therefore, the philosophy of it we could leave out. But what caused the people to sin in their hearts? How was the Yetzer Hara successful in getting them to sin? Or as he calls it, may igra rama libira mikta shalcheto egel. Tzorach lohavan eichich shilu mayetzer bedarva shenei ochotz afilu es haposhet shebi Yisrael. Here the Yetzer Hara gets all the Jews practically to in one form or another acquiesce to the sin of the eagle, where generally even a regular Jew would never reach this thing. How was it that he suddenly and rapidly went to the lowest of pits? Maher, as the Torah calls it, quickly. Rather than step by step incremental approach that we said that the Yetzer Hara generally employs. How did this happen? Says Reb Chaim Shmulev, it's a very important insight, and this is going to be very, very important for us today. Because the psychology, rather than the philosophy, is always going to be current. People are still people. Philosophies change, ideologies change, intelligence and intellectualism changes, and what's faddish and what's current and vogue always changes. All ideologies change. But the underlying psychology of what makes people tick is always there. So although we don't have Hegels nowadays and the philosophies are not relevant, but the lessons of the psychological underpinnings and insights as to why they sin are relevant and current. Therefore, I'm using this. So, what's important to always be aware of is not how people justify their sins, but rather what makes them tick. And that is important today as well, as we'll eventually get to. So, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz begins and explains like this. Kosovitz says, as we've learned, Vayar ha'om ki boishesh Moshe loredes min ha'ar. The people saw Moshe delayed in coming down, Vayikoh ha'om al ha'aron, again, we saw this possible. Again, this has to do with the times that they expected Moshe to descend. This is the Rashi which we saw. Herod was choshech v'afela. It became dark, cloudy, confused. The was onon v'arofel. Smoky and cloudy, virvuvia, and confused. Omer lem Moshe, Rabchem Hechonu. The Sultan says to the Jews and gets them to start thinking, what happened to your leader Moshe? Omer lo olamorm, they responded, he's in heaven. Omer lohem bo sheish, the sixth hour that he should have descended came, and he's not here. Lo hishgichu, but at first they didn't accept the Sultan. Herulam dimus mitosatul, they saw the image of his coffin. Behind the Kavalei Laron, Kizem Moshe is Sherelo Nemeret Tzamu Yidanu Mahoyolo, as I pointed out from the next Rashi, when they said, Kizem Moshe, this man Moshe, they were able to point. Ironic how a month and a half earlier, actually more than that, 2 months earlier, 3 months earlier, they said, Zeh Kelivan, they were able to see the heavens, see God, and say, this is my God. Zeh Kelivan. Here they say, Zeh Moshe is dead. They also had a vision of Moshe being dead. Next paragraph. Kan gilu lonu chazal, eich nechshlu Yisrael b'cheto egel. With this critical information, we could understand why the people sinned and how they came about to sin. As we pointed out, Moshe was their leader, he was their guide, he showed them every way to go. He taught them, he was their master, their teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu, as we call him. He was their guide, he was their father, he was their mentor, he was their teacher. He was their leader in everything. All of a sudden, in their minds, Moshe's dead. The Sultan is showing them the image of Moshe's coffin in the air. That's the confusion that Rashi was referring to. It became very murky and cloudy and dark to them. The loss of a parent, the sudden loss of a parent, that you're so dependent upon. They're like children. They're like becoming orphaned at a very young age. They were still in their formative stage. The Jews just came out of Egypt. This was only 3 months later. And they were in a very delicate, in a very vulnerable state, like little children not expecting their parents to die. When you get older, you're independent. If a parent gets sick, with slow passage of time, you're already on your own 2 feet. The parent's getting older, you're less dependent on the parent. Sometimes it switches, the parent becomes dependent on you. And the aging process comes in. And also you're already expecting it. It's normal. It's normal for children to lose their parents. It's a normal thing. And as the parent gets older and sicker and more feeble, and you're already more independent and less dependent on the parent, when that happens, it's tragic and very sad, but it's not devastating. It doesn't devastate the person. If you're young and it's sudden and you're dependent and the parent is everything that you have in your whole life revolves and depends on the parent, and you're not expecting it, it's unexpected, and you're young and vulnerable and dependent, and then the parent dies, it's more than just tragic, it's more than just sad, it's devastating. It's devastating to the person. The Jews collectively were children and vulnerable and delicate in a formative stage like children. Moshe was their everything. He was their guide, their mentor, their teacher, their parent. All of a sudden, unexpectedly, Moshe is dead. L'neged einayim choshech afeilo onan varofa. They're confused. They're out in the wilderness, in the desert. They don't know where they're going. They're in a state of utter confusion. They lost everything with this. They're broken. They're shattered completely by losing their leader, their guide, their everything. The father of all prophets. You can imagine their state, their shock, their reaction. Not only are they saddened in mourning, but they're literally shocked. And they're scared, they're frightened. They're stunned. The matzav zeh, when a person is like that, when he's shocked and shattered and broken, that's where the satan is able to shortcut his way and get anything that he wants, without having to go through the incremental step-by-step state. The matzav zeh yochol ha-sotan lifo mashen biyodu b'matzav rogo. The sotan can successfully accomplish his mission in a way that he normally wouldn't be able to when things are normal. When the matzav, as they refer to it now in Israel, is regular, is ragil, the matzav ragil, when things are normal and regular, the satan has to work very, very slowly, incrementally, trying to get people to sin. But when you're devastated and shocked, and you fall into the depths of depression, atzvus, the momentum of the fall is such that the satan can take you wherever he wants to take you. Normally, the satan has to go slowly. But when a person, Adam nivol v'oyevein eitzos, when you've lost hope, when you feel hopeless, and there doesn't seem to be any light at the end of the tunnel, and the world is dark, and you're confused and depressed, and you feel hopeless, then you're in the greatest danger. V'sakona g'doylo hu lipol mei igra rama l'bira mikta. You can fall from the heights to the depths. The Yetzirah doesn't have to incrementally build his case. He doesn't have to build his case for Avodah Zarah. But you suddenly and rapidly can decline in depression to whatever the Yetzirah wants. Elafilu b'pam achas lidei chet. So the Yetzer Hara has the shortcut of depression. He's able to make you fall immediately and rapidly to the lowest level. The momentum of nefila, of falling, propels the fall much more rapidly. Anybody that ever studies the stock market sees how true it is. It has nothing to do with the fundamentals. It has to do with the psychology of the market. the psychology of the people. All of, actually we use the same word, I mean, what's worse than a recession? Depression, right? Worse than a recession is depression. And it's all about psychology. It's all about the mentality of the people. It's what they call the big mo, right? What's the big mo? You know what the big mo is?
Momentum.
The big mo, momentum. When stocks are flying and everybody, was a few years ago, and how long ago now, 2 years ago, when the dot-coms were soaring and we're sitting around in this room and it was around the turn of the millennium, and they're saying, nah, this isn't the way. I remember one gentleman in this room telling another gentleman in this room who was following with his stocks portfolio the old-fashioned way. It was like going from 30 to 31. It was moving up at a paltry 20-30% a year. I mean, like 20-30% a year? That was nothing. The stocks were moving 50% in a day, right? 20 points per day. You remember what it was. And it was doubling and tripling and quadrupling in a year. And no one thought of that as being unusual. If it would quadruple in a year, no one thought quadruple in a year. It went from 50 to 200. It took a whole year for it to go from 50 to 200. It should have been going every year. It should have been done in 3 months. Right? All of a sudden, the big mo is there. And in the big mo, everybody's buying and it's going on. Are the fundamentals there? And if you spoke to people, they would rationalize it away. You ask them, where are the fundamentals? Is it profit? Could it ever be as profitable as the momentum indicates? No, of course not. But it shouldn't be. In fact, there was a whole theory. I mean, I heard this from many people that were much more educated in economics than I am. But I heard this from many people, that it's just the opposite. If there's fundamentals there, that there's earnings, then you're not going to go. It's going to go slowly because everybody's in fundamentals. If there's nothing there, and it's not making anything, it's in the Luftaran, it's floating in the air like Moshe Rabbeinu's coffin, which is what ultimately happened to all of this. If it's floating in the air with nothing there, then it's going to soar because of this. And I heard all the cheshbon, it didn't make any sense, but that's the way it's going. Listen, you got to cash in. And you got to join the new technology, right? And I heard from some wise people that had street smarts, right? I heard from people that had street smarts and knew better and should have known better. This is the new world. It's a new world. It's not the 30-40% a year. It's the 30-40% a month. And you got to double your money every year at least. And that's the way it's going now. You're going to be an instant millionaire and billionaire. And when the bubble burst, Enron. We all know what happened to Enron. I know a fellow who everybody advised when Enron was $10. Now, cash in. What was Enron originally? I didn't really follow it so much.
60s, 70s.
I think it was in the 80s even.
Yeah.
And when it fell down to $10, this guy invested a lot into it. But the momentum over there, the fundamentals, finally, when it burst, collapsed like a dam. And all the dot-coms started falling and falling. And the big mo is now working in the opposite direction. It's working with gravity rather than anti-gravity. It's working with, and it's accelerating, and falls and falls and falls. And the stock market actually has rules placed into that when it falls a certain thing, they have to stop it precisely because they're aware of this concept. That since what carries something down is not always the fundamentals, it's not always because it should go down, but it's the psychology of people, the mass panic, which builds on itself, so therefore they stop trading at a certain point. And the recession is a recession because of people's mentality, and the depression is worse than a recession also because of people's mentality. But it's not only a depression in the market, it's a depression in the mind. It's a depression of the mind and it's in the mind. And this is not only true with economics, it's true in everything else. Depression. When they get sad and they do tshuva, it's one thing. But depression is something totally different. Depression and melancholy never works to a spiritual advantage. It doesn't. It only leads a person down. It leads into self-destructive behavior. What you're talking about is that when events happen that wake people up and call them to tshuva and repentance, but not if you're in a state of melancholy or depression. That person is very vulnerable. Sometimes they will rise out of that, and it depends, but the Yetzer Hara has a very vulnerable person that's easy to...
I mean, you know, you read the papers every day now, you get depressed. You're depressed.
That's exactly why I said it's very current.
But you're not necessarily turning
away. The weekly toll of dead Jewish children has left Israel, listen, like a mighty but dazed boxer on the corner stool without any fight, dreading the bell. Jerusalem Post concludes on February 18th, a chorus of defeatism can be heard in the land. Yediot Achronot, February 17th, writes that these are murky days, Irvuvia, murky, cloudy days. Haaretz sees an atmosphere of frustration and despair. Myriv's editorial, Ariel Sharon's struggle is strategy is crumbling, with no results expected except blood and ruin. A war without victors. The Village Voice, headlines, Israelis contemplate the unthinkable, moving out, escaping the hell of the Holy Land. And it cites the Idiot Achronot in reporting that some of the children and grandchildren of David Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, and Yitzhak Rabin, among others, have already left Israel, as have the children of some of Israel's current cabinet members. Then it talks about mental health experts saying that many are using denial or escapism to cope. Zev Schief in Haaretz talks about how Israeli television stressed that the people's strength has been exhausted, and they're talking about leaving Israel. The national morale will affect the results of the confrontation. Yet what happens when we masochistically inflict anxieties on ourselves? Even the United States is getting worried about its depressed little buddy. Jerusalem Post, February 17th, says Washington is concerned over a weakening of Israeli will. The reports point to an erosion in national resilience in the face of continuing terror. Then you have all about these reservists that are constantly being highlighted in the New York Times for refusing to serve. And writes a whole piece about this malaise. And it goes on and on. There's a malaise in the land, of Israel, and there's depression. Just yesterday I saw an op-ed piece in the Jerusalem Post about a person that basically wrote, okay, he's one of these rabbis for human rights, and said, listen, we can't be like the Arabs are, and they're willing to kill us for their cause over and over again, and we'll never be able to be like them. So we might as well just give up now. He doesn't use the word surrender, but basically his whole article is about, it's just time to surrender and give it up. Give up. But once you're giving up, what are you giving up? Where are you giving up? Once you've lost, and you've even discussed and floated the trial balloon of giving up Jerusalem, yeah, our bias, do we really, we can live without it, we can live without this. You give up one thing after the other, we'll give up 80% of the settlements, 90%, give up Gilo, big deal. So we'll give up Gilo. Neighborhood of Yerushalayim, what's the big deal? Once already you float the trial balloon, okay, we're going to let in 200,000 Arabs at 300,000, you just give up. It goes on and on, there's never an end. And where did this begin? This began by this great victory known as the withdrawal from Lebanon. That everybody said, what a wonderful thing at the time. And that's where it began. Because they didn't leave in an orderly way. They left like they were in a panic. In one or two nights, disorganized. The Hezbollah, the Arabs, viewed as their one major victory. And from there they learned a chizuk. They're mechazik themselves, that they're going to be able to drive us out. And people are now talking about what they're doing in the West Bank as being another Lebanonization, as if it's Lebanon. There's no end. The West Bank is Lebanon, this settlement. So you give them back that, you give it back. There's no end to it. Until finally people say, what am I living in Israel for? I might as well move to San Francisco. Go to San Francisco, you'll see a lot of people there that said this. Go to New York, hail a cab, he's either going to be an Arab or an Israeli. But you just give up. When you give up, the momentum of depression is such that you're open to all dangers. All dangers. It's true with the stock market. Well, the stock market is where you see the most, because you see these rapid rises and declines based on the psychology, the momentum. But it's true with the economy as a whole. That's what a recession and a depression is all about. And it's true with people. Market is a mass psychology. A depression is a mass psychology. But each individual on his own level is in that danger. Asher korcho baderach, Amole comes and begins by cooling you off. Rashi says the word korcho has three meanings. Mikra, carry, or krirus. One translation of the word asher korcho is to cool you off. But especially when you're on a way, asher korcho baderach, the long journey tends to wear people down. And once you give up hope, and first it begins by being cooled off, but then it goes to a state of defeatism and depression, then you're in danger of every kind of possible decline. Because then the momentum is there, and you could easily reach Avodah Zarah, and you give it all up. You have to just get into that state, into that mode of defeatism and depression. And that begins with that cooling off that Amalek does. Asher korcho baderach. And especially when you're on a derech, when you're on a way, you're learning, you're steiging, you're this, and you start getting worn down with all kinds of troubles, and then you finally give it up. It goes from asher korcho baderach to the melancholy despair of depression. And when that happens, there's a momentum of defeatism that makes you fall like a plummeting stock market. That's the danger of depression, of atzvus, of melancholy, of defeatism. Let's go on and see more about this. And that's why the Yetzer Hara is able to get in a state of depression. You're primed for the Yetzer Hara. You're primed for the Yetzer Hara to immediately and rapidly cause you to fall. Now he gives a few examples of this. We find this in many places. Ksiv, Vahi b'yosem basoda. They were in the field. Vayomer Kain el Hevel. We know how Kain kills Hevel and becomes a murderer. Here we talk about the Egel, it's Avodah Zarah. There are three cardinal sins. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayas, Shvichas Damim. It's interesting. I mean, I guess I don't have to, expound on it. Everybody realizes that when spouses are in a fight and one spouse is depressed, they're very vulnerable to affairs. That's when affairs happen. When one spouse is angry at the other or depressed, in a state of depression, you're vulnerable. Murder. Murder most foul. When you're in a state of depression and you're feeling very down, you're capable of murder. Avodah Zarah, we've just seen the example of the eagle. A classic example of murder is Cain and Hevel. What does it have to do with Cain and Hevel? Kosef Shabbatar Gmiyanis Menuziel Ani Cain Vomar Lehevel. Cain said to Hevel, Les din v'les dain. There is no God, there's no judgment. Les oylem acher, there's no future world, there's no future. V'les lemeitin agrotov l'tzadikai v'les lemifim in rishiyah. There is no reward, there's no punishment, not for the righteous, not for the wicked. How did that happen? Hadover tmu admoi, this is also perplexing. Cain just offered a sacrifice to God. And the next day, he's already saying there is no God, there's no judgment, there's no reward, there's no punishment, there's no world to come, there is no future. How did that happen? Heinad heinoi a Cain oivid Hashem. Cain is the one that initially thought of the idea of serving God with a sacrifice. It wasn't Hevel's idea, it was Cain's idea. Cain is the one that initiated the idea of let's serve God by bringing some offering to Hashem, a korban. Cain came up with the idea of bringing a korban to Hashem, something which the rest of the Torah is full of. Whose idea was it? Cain. He said, let's. Hevel was a noch gekommen. He was a noch schlepper. The Hevel gam hu, Hevel also brought. But Hevel also brought. A noch schlepper. Kain initiated the idea. And yet Kain now, a day later, is denying God's existence. He understood the whole concept, all the mystical underpinnings to the idea of offerings and korbanos, as the Ramban says. And he had communication with God. God asked him, he responded. What does it mean to now deny God? How does he deny God? He was a Novi, he was a prophet himself. Ella. Because of the Targum Sham, but if you analyze the Pasuk carefully, you'll see an insight. And you'll see the previous insight as well. Yovan, you'll see that when did this occur? It was a response to his depression, to his failure, to his refusal by God that God turns away from him. As a result, he went into depression. Yovan, ki amai soya miyad la'achar sheshokas baruch al minchas hevel ve minchas kain lo shah. God gives Hevel's Korban primacy and not Kain's. And what does it say regarding how Kain felt? Pasuk says, Vayichar l'Kain ma'od. And Kain becomes exceedingly upset over this. Vayiplu ponov. And his face falls. What does it mean, face falling? Depression. It means yirida, that you fell. His face falls. He's depressed. Vayiplu ponov. Kol kachor l'kayin. It affected him. He was so upset. His face fell like a person that's suddenly shocked. When you're shocked, your jaw drops. Right? When you're startled, and you're surprised, and you're shocked, your face falls. By saying that Cain was refused and his face fell, means that he went into a shock at the refusal of his korban to be accepted. He went into a state of shocked depression. Once that happens, anything can happen. Like we said earlier, the Yetzer Hara is able to find that and to utilize that as a shortcut approach to getting you to do anything. Once you're in a state of shocked depression, the Yetzer Hara can rule you without boundary, without bound. Afilu b'basachas, even in one instant, you could fall from the highest to the lowest, el tohoim hakfira v'achiruf, to blasphemy itself, and to murder. And that's what led to murder. What led to murder was the same thing that led to his denial, to his heresy. That's what led to his blasphemy. That's it. I give up. There's nothing. And once you give up and his face falls in depression, he's prone to anything. The Yetzer Hara finds that as the entry to blasphemy and heresy and even murder. Another example, and this is an interesting example because it goes to the third of the cardinal sins, Gilui Arayos. We just gave two examples. Avodah Zarah, heresy, denial of God, blasphemy, and murder, adultery, or moral depravity. The three cardinal sins, the Yetzer Hara gets to you with depression. Not with a step-by-step approach, but with depression, the shortcut approach. The Dugman Noikevis, Lizdoirus, Pesoim Shalom, Ketoitzom, Miziazu, and Nafshoi, and we could see likewise that shock depression brings the person to total depravity. With the daughter-in-law of Naomi, the story of Ruth. Ruth and Orpah were daughters-in-law of Naomi. And in the beginning, they both came back together with Naomi. They wanted to join the Jewish people. They were willing to leave Moab and convert and join the Jewish people. But all of a sudden, Naomi tells Orpah some depressing things. Says, listen, you think it's going to be all peaches and cream? Life is not going to be a bowl of cherries as a convert. It's not going to be roses. It's going to be a lot of bitter pills you're going to have to swallow. You're going to have a hard time finding a shidduch. I don't have any more children. I can't raise you children for husbands. What are you going to do? You're going to be forlorn and alone as a ger. Go back. Go back. What's the point of coming along? And Naomi speaks to her in a way that depresses her. And initially, she had the same feeling of gung-ho inspiration as Ruth. She began with the same desire to cleave to God as Ruth. As it says in the Pasuk, we're going to go back with you. We want to join you. Naomi responds, no, go back home. So she tries to dissuade both of them. And they begin to cry. And there's all kinds of depression going on. It's a very morose, melancholy section in the Navi. The Pasuk says, Orpah kisses her goodbye, but Rus cleaves strongly to her mother-in-law. Mitchila midibur shtein Rus v'Orpah b'loshen achas. You see, originally they both spoke with one voice. They begin by saying, we're going to return with you. We're going to go back to your people. Orpah, like Rus, came to this great realization that, yes, I'm going to leave my people, I'm going to leave Moab and live amongst the Jews as one of them. So she came to the same spiritual awareness, that same spiritual recognition of the great move of spirituality that she wanted to do together with Rus, the same inspiration, the same aspiration, the same lofty goal of joining the Jews, willing to sacrifice and to leave her people. But then Naomi speaks to her and gets her down and gets her depressed. She lost it. Naomi talked her into going back, giving it up. But once you give it up, and you give something up suddenly, you sink, and you decline rapidly, like the stock market that's crashing. It's the crash of the human mind, the human psychology, the human stock market. It's a crash. It falls rapidly. And she leaves her mother-in-law crying. She kisses her, and they both raise their voices and they cry. And she walks away with tears streaming down her faces. And Jerry said, isn't that what people do tshuva? Yes, there are tears and there are tears. There's crying and there's crying. Crying of melancholy, crying of depression doesn't lead to any good. The crying, the tears of depression are never good tears. Tears of repentance are good tears. Tears of depression are not good tears. Very important lesson. When Orpah leaves Rus, she's leaving tshuva. Rus both wanted to do tshuva, they wanted to repent. But when she hears what Naomi says, I'm going to go back, I'm going to be alone, I'm going to be a gioris, forlorn and alone, and there's nothing there. Life is going to be difficult. She leaves her mother-in-law and sister-in-law, or sister actually in this case, crying with bitter tears streaming down her face. She's depressed. And in depression, she leaves her mother-in-law. Virus Dovkabo, but Rus, this Alsal Ruma Milo Rus, cleaves very strongly to her mother-in-law. She didn't have the power. What happens? Once she starts declining, once she gives up, that's what it was. She was almost there. She was on the same level as Rus. Almost there. Almost, just about. And at the last minute, she gives it up. And she turns around and goes away. And she leaves. She leaves. She leaves Rus and she leaves Naomi. And that last stage, that critical turning around, she begins a fall. Borol hechnigia ma'irulo, Chazal say in the Medrash, Oysa laila shapirsha orpa mechamoysa, that night that she left her mother-in-law, she met a troop of 100 soldiers, brigands, and she prostituted herself to all of them. In fact, her name Orpah, which is the back of the neck, symbolizes some of the way that she committed acts unnaturally as well. Rav Tanchum Omer Af Kelav Achan. There was a dog in that troop as well. 101, 100 people and a dog, and she prostituted herself to all of them unnaturally, even one night. How do you go from almost making it to the greatest of moral depravity? The Gemara in Saita says Loma Nikra Shmo Orpah. Why was she called Orpah, which means the back of the neck? Shakol Orphan, because everybody, she prostituted herself to everybody. She made herself hefker to everybody, naturally and unnaturally. How does that happen? Ezon the filo ayuma machridam. How can that be? Mimatzah shalakor and one of the bari oilam, from coming to the state of almost making it, recognizing the and willing to give up your nation, give up your people, move out of your land, to become a stranger in a strange land because you believe and you aspire to spiritual greatness. How do you come from such aspirations of spiritual greatness? The Boyer Oilam of Torah, the Torah of Jews and God Himself, Adam Kulkela Shabumas, so she becomes the most depraved and the most promiscuous. Ubiyoim Echot, and it all was in one day. Haitochen Kedavar Hazeh, can people sink that rapidly from a state of spiritual greatness and spiritual inspiration to a state of promiscuous moral depravity to such a degree, all in one day? And the answer is yes. That is human psychology, that is human nature. And again, this is the Yetzer Hara's pattern. Elach b'derech z'unovin zois, we could understand it with the above. Ki b'rois ha'shloyom du b'nisoyin ha'gotl, when she saw that she couldn't stand with this great challenge, with the great nisoyin, and unlike her sister, she gives it up. Once you give up everything. She gave up. Defeatism, it's a crumbling. That's the article that I just read you. There is a sense of defeatism in the land. I mean, if it's true. Again, it might be that they're writing the obituary a little bit too prematurely. Israel is not necessarily like that. I'm merely highlighting the dangers of that. That once you reach the level of depression and defeatism, that you've given up. Once Orpah gives up, you go anywhere. And although she was on the highest level, but when she saw she couldn't do it like her sister, she just can't measure up to what her sister was doing. Who's stronger, us or the Palestinians? Is it Orpah or Rus? Who's stronger? Who's greater? And if you don't have the ability to withstand the nisayon, the challenges, and you begin to give up, and you withdraw from Lebanon in a panic, and let's withdraw from Yosef's tomb in a panic, and they're in Nablus, and it says the tanks surrounded it. The tanks had it surrounded. They were about to recapture Shechem, the Yosef's tomb. They were surrounding it. And there were Palestinians there that were going to fight. But they had these Palestinians surrounded by tanks. And the last minute the tanks decided to forget it. They turned around and they drove away. Defeatism. They're strong. They want it very badly. We're not so strong. And once you're willing to give up, you could be in a tank, in a plane, and it doesn't help you. You have that one person standing in Tiananmen Square, and all the tanks are there, but if you lost the psychological push, you've lost that moral imperative to drive you on, you can't. You turn tail and run. You withdraw. And the same way they withdrew from Lebanon, they withdrew from Yosef's tomb, and they couldn't bring themselves to recapturing it, even with tanks. They couldn't bring themselves to recapturing it because they're stronger. Orpah sees Rus, my sister, is strong. I am weak. I'm not strong enough. And once you give up, you give it all up. Once you admit to some defeat, you fall into the momentum of total defeat. And that's what we're talking about, the momentum of the fall. The momentum of the fall. And therefore, she goes. She can't be like her sister. Hikira b'tu'usa amora. She cries the bitter tears of melancholy and depression, not the tears of tshuva. but she sees that she's unworthy and unfit and not as good as her sister. She realized that she's making a mistake and she couldn't withstand the Nisoyan, and therefore she falls and falls all the way to the bottom like an animal. And that's how the Yetzer Hara wins, or one of the ways. The Yetzer Hara has many methods, but that's why I'm learning this piece, because it highlights one of the Yetzer Hara's major weapons, and it's something which nowadays is very timely, because we're in danger of this particular issue. Let's go on. He quotes the Gemara in Chagiga. You just made a seam on Chagiga. If you remember this, Rebbe Havanokit Sefer Kinus V'Kokori Begave Kimoto Lahai Posuk Hishlich Mishamayim Oretz, the Posuk in Kinus that says God cast us down from heaven onto earth. Nofal Ninyoda, he was so shocked by it that he dropped the Megillah in his hand. Like, it was just like so overwhelming. It was the concept of falling from heaven to earth. What a fall. From heaven to earth, from heavenliness, from Jews being in a heavenly state to being in a state of lowliness. He dropped the kinnus, the Megillah. Omar, and he said, May Igra Lot Ramal Labira Amikta, from the highest of roofs to the lowest of the pits. Hamaim Raza Tumu, Kimar Keshri Yesh Ben Nefilim Megillahs, Hakinus Miyodol Ben Mashomer Rebbe Alaposik, Hishlech Mishamayim Oretz. What's the connection between the dropping of the Megillah and the Pasuk that he read in the Megillah, where he responds, Me'igur Rav Labiram Mikta? He says, V'yesh Tafrash, HaKavona B'zeh Ki Rosh Ein Naf Kamina Le'Megillah Atzim Beinem Yimenucha V'mokam Gavoya V'Rav Le'Beinem Menucha L'Mata Boretz El Shenigram Nezek Le'Megillah Ardei Etzim Nefilah. It's important to be aware that it's not so much where something is, but the momentum of the acceleration or deceleration. If the Megillah is on a roof, it's on a roof. If it's on a table, it's on a table. If it's on a chair, it's on a chair. If it's on a floor, it's a floor. Nothing will damage it. It's only the momentum of the fall from the roof to the ground and the accelerated nature of the fall that brings about the damage. Momentum itself creates damage. Nefilah, the fall creates damage. Not the location, but it's the fall. If a person is on a high level spiritually, or on a low level spiritually, it's not as bad as the person that's in a decline. The person that's declining is in a danger of declining so rapidly that he goes into what we call free fall. Momentum, that's much worse. If the market is high or the market is low, is not important as the direction of the market and its rate of acceleration and deceleration. If the market is moving rapidly a certain way, that's what you have to bear in mind. Not where the market is. You're talking about market forces. The force of a fall, the force of depression and depressive fall is worse and more injurious than the location of where you're at. That's what Rebbe understood. To fall from the heaven to the earth, like the Megillah that fell down, the damage is caused by the actual fall and the momentum of the fall. Shehi ha-goyremes, the nezek, the damage comes through the fall itself, the momentum. Shehi ha-goyremes l'kri is a sefer v'kalkulo. It's what's called in physics, the, you know, come on, when you accelerate, but the energy, I don't know, kinetic energy, but there's another term for it. Not inertia. Inertia is what keeps you from doing it. But what do you refer to the resistance of acceleration and the way it affects things? Yeah, I guess so. And I'm here with all these educated people. It's very depressing that my little Tell's high school education does it. Okay. But there's a law of physics that when these things happen, then there's damage. The momentum, the whatever you want to call it, maybe it's called momentum, that's what it is, maybe. Shia Goyremes, that's what caused it to rip and to become torn. That's what Rebbe understood from the fall of the Megillah. Because he had a new insight in the Pasuk, because he dropped the Megillah. What's the connection? Yeah, I mean, it's a very distant connection. What insight did the Rebbe gain by dropping the Megillah to the inner meanings of the pasuk? But that's what he saw. He saw that what creates the damage and tears the Megillah is not where the Megillah was or is, it's the fact that it fell and the momentum of that fall damages it. He says, if that's the case, then what happened to the Jews? God cast us out from the heavens and we fell to the earth. It's not an issue where we were and where we are, it's the fact we span that distance so quickly and rapidly that there's a momentum of fall that happens that's very damaging. That's what creates what?
Acceleration.
That's what creates the damage. And therefore he says, not only Shemul Vada Yuridishal Kangsov Shrim was not only was there a decline and a fall, but Oyakam Nezik Shal Etzman the Fila. There's the additional damage of the fall itself, besides the actual loss that we have. Not only did we lose by not being on the level that we were before, but in the actual decline and fall, there was more damage that occurred, and that's what Rebbe understood as the inside of dropping the Megillah. And therefore, there's a nezek of the etzem nefilo v'chabota ho'aza, and the resistance that comes about when you fall. Come on, the igur rov l'bira mikta. For that reason, Chazal tell us that the worst of all is the Jew that was a Talmud Chacham and a Tzaddik and learned but left it. Worse than the Amoras. Worse than the person that never learned is the one that was there and gave it up and left. Because not only is now separated and away from Torah, which is bad enough, same like anybody being distant from Torah. It's bad to be distant from Torah. But because he was there, and now he's distant, there's an acceleration and a momentum of movement which is damaging. He was originally a Talmud Chacham. He's in a state of decline and fall. The nature of the momentum of fall, that the break of that fall, that when you hit rock bottom, it's much more damaging. Who knows how far that momentum will take you? You're in a state of decline and fall. Who knows how far it will go? The Yetzer Hara has a shortcut. Once you're defeating, once you're leaving, once you're moving, once you're giving up on battle, that's why Chazal say that there were people in charge during battle to not let anybody retreat. Because once you're retreating, it causes panic, and everybody will panic, and all is lost. Who knows how far a retreat will go? You retreat, who knows how far? The 67th war was one with momentum. It was one with momentum, and the retreat of the Egyptians and of the Syrians and the Jordanians. Once they're in a state of retreat, it's so rapid that they took off their shoes to run, and there were those stacks and piles of shoes. There was a momentum. The momentum of victory, the momentum of defeat, the momentum of retreat is so great that we don't know where it ends. A person that learns Torah and leaves Torah is in a state of retreat. We don't know how far the momentum of that retreat will go. Like we see again from Orpah. So we have three classic examples of how momentum of decline affects the three cardinal sins. Avodah Zarah, the ego, heresy and disbelief and atheism and blasphemy with Cain, murder, Cain and Hevel, moral depravity and promiscuity, Orpah. Three examples of depression and decline and its momentum, how far it could lead a person. Therefore, Chazal say that a person that's in a spiritual decline, like we see by Orpah, or the person that learned and is there, but is now leaving it, the greater the mountain, the English expression is, right? The bigger you are, the harder you fall. The greater you are, the harder the fall. The greater the mountain that you're on, so great is the decline, the fall, you're falling off of a higher mountain. The momentum is such that when you hit rock bottom, it's much more devastating, much more destructive. Therefore, the shana uparish, the person that learns but leaves learning, the pirshnik, kosher mikulon, is the hardest and the worst of all. Therefore, says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, we have to learn a tremendous lesson from this. And therefore, a person has to be very, very careful about himself to keep your psychological well-being intact. In Margish Ezer Yerida B'Madregosa, if you find a little bit of a fall from your level, again, Asher Kor Chobaderech, it begins with Amalek cooling you off. It's a long way, a long journey, and you become weary and tired, and it cools you off. Baderech, in the long road, Korcham. If you start feeling that decline, if you start feeling that you're really, you got to make sure to apply the brakes, because if you're going down a mountain and your brakes begin to fail and you don't stop in the beginning, then your brakes have fallen and faltered and you go all the way. You have to put on the brakes in the beginning of a decline, because it's bad enough that you're in a state of decline. You don't want the momentum of the decline to take you further than you otherwise would go. You're declining. It happens. People decline. It happens all the time. You go up and you go down. It's like the stock market. It goes up and down, up and down. People constantly go up and down. Fine. Expect that you're going to decline. But don't let the momentum of that decline carry you further than the decline itself should have. You will decline. You will lose some of it. And when you lose it, you have to accept that that's going to happen. But do not allow its momentum to take you even further than you otherwise would have gone. Because you could ruin and destroy more. More devastating is the momentum of the decline, do you read the? More so than whatever brought about the decline. Whatever the fundamentals are, is one thing. Certain stocks are depressed. Why? Not because of the fundamentals, but because of the momentum. Always recognize yourself like a stock. That you have to read yourself what the fundamentals are that cause the decline. Don't be lower than that. Don't be lower than the matzav that you're in deserves. Yes, you decline, and the matzav that you're in brings you to the decline. But don't be lower than that decline by allowing its momentum to carry you further. But you'll be more devastated and damaged by its momentum than the actual fundamentals of what brought the decline. If you could put on the brakes and realize that although you're down, you shouldn't give up complete hope and complete decline, but protect yourself, at least according to what level you're on, to at least be on that level to apply the brakes, this person has hope. He'll get up and he will rise yet again. You'll be able to go up and accelerate and go higher and higher. A person that knows how to apply brakes, brakes his decline, expect decline. It's going to happen. And there'll be times that you're depressed. But if you're able to conquer the depression and you're able to deal with it, so that it doesn't create its own momentum of decline, you'll apply the brakes. You're down, down but not out. That's the person that there's hope that he'll eventually reascend and go back to levels that he was at before and beyond. To such a person there's hope. If you know how to apply the brakes, you'll go up higher. You're fighting the Yetzer Hara of the momentum of depression and decline. That's why Chazal saying, this is a beautiful pshat. We know that Shlomo HaMelech, according to the Gemara and the Midrashim, lost. He was Koheles, right? We talked about Koheles, you asked about. So he was a Melech al Yerushalayim. Chazal say, take a look what happened to him. He started off being a king over a vast empire. He was thrown away by Ashmedai, the demon, and he was searching in this, and he started losing his kingdom one after the other, till by the end he lost, he was no longer empire, no longer the country, no longer even Yerushalayim, the capital. By the end he had nothing. All he had was his staff, his scepter, whatever you want to call it, the staff of the king, and his cloak. So Chazal say, in a kind of ironic way, that By the end, he only ruled over his staff and his cloak. In the beginning, he had this vast empire that he ruled over. He was king over an empire. Now he's only the king over his garment, over his cloak, and over his staff. It was the king, right? He had it all. He had a great empire. And all of a sudden, you're down to your wardrobe. It's all you have left. But he's still walking around like a prince, like a king. I remember, I never understood it, but my mother, when we left Hungary and we went to Austria, and she converted everything that we had from Hungarian currency to Austrian currency. We had to pay off the people, and from our vast estates and everything, we were almost penniless. When we got to New York already, after going from Hungary to Austria to Germany, we took an army transport plane, took us to New York. And my mother, being a widow already at that point, it was just me and my brother, her first job was to sew girdles, and she was given 25 cents for each girdle that she sewed. The first girdle took her 4 hours to sew. 25 cents for 4 hours of work. And she worked as a cook, and this, I mean, like, then finally, we have a catering. That fell apart for a reason or other, broken half. She had to start it again. My brother now has a successful catering from my mother. But we left Hungary from great wealth and some affluence and some stature and nobility to, I was in Austria already in a hospital where with a bunch of old sick people, and I had to go to the toilet, and I was 3 years old, and the nuns gave me a wet pail and a wet shmata to use for toilet paper to make in the middle of the room. I mean, that's, you go from the heights to the depths. And I remember my mother told me, or my brother, that with some of the last money that she had, she bought me like a down winter, you know, whatever you want to call it, for a three-year-old, as well as a ruffled shirt. And I thought, what a waste. You know, you take hard-earned money, or very, you know, money that you don't have much of at this point, and you waste it on such a seemingly extravagant luxury. But then later on I understood that if you maintain your dignity, even when you're down and you have nothing left, so you're an aristocrat without anything to be an aristocrat over. You're a noble, you're a ruler, you're a king over what? You're a king over your staff. You're a king over yourself, you still have your dignity. You're down to that last little piece of potato kugel, that's all you have left, or a wet noodle, but you still put your you know, a napkin on your thing, and you take out a knife and fork, and you delicately cut up that little noodle into little pieces, and you eat it like a gentleman. You're still a gentleman. You have hope of regaining it. You're down but not out. You have hope of regaining it. Chazal say, therefore, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, it's a tremendous insight. They weren't just commenting on the irony that he was first king over a vast empire, and now he's king over nothing but a staff. He was indeed a king over his staff. He was still a king. He still had a staff. He acted like a king, and he was king over his wardrobe, his cloak. That's all he had left, but he still had it. And therefore, there was hope that he's going to regain his empire, which he ultimately did. Chazal, therefore, saying, B'soif molach al maklo, and they say, by the end, he only ruled over his staff. No, they're saying more than that. By the end, he was still a king over his staff. The Hainu Shlach, La'achar and the Fila, Shehoiso etzlo, that in spite of the rapid decline and that he did, he still had the strength of character. Himzi la'atzma chochmi kol odom. Wise as he was, he understood psychology, and we know Shlomo Melech, the greatness of Shlomo Melech wasn't his intellectual achievements, although he apparently was that also. But we all know, what was Shlomo Melech's great wisdom? He was the psychologist par excellence. When he had those two women in him, and he had to decide who's the real mother, what did he do? He employed a psychological evaluation of what motherhood is all about and how people react. He saw the people in front of them, and he put them to a test where he was able to discover who the true mother was. It wasn't with DNA evidence. That's what they use nowadays. It was a big deal. You put it into a computer, you put it into a lab, you take a DNA sample of the baby, of the dead baby, the live baby, this mother, that mother, and you could match it, and DNA match will tell you who the mother is and who the child is. That's the way they do it nowadays. Sure, that's one way of doing it, with technology, or with other kinds of insightful things, with evidence. The genius that he that he employed over there was the genius of psychological insight. Shlomo Melech therefore was wise in psychology, and he understood himself that if he wants to regain it, he has to still be the gentleman and the king that he always was. Lebesoif Molach al Maklo, he was still a ruler over his staff. Even after his fall, the Chochem Mikol Adam found a genius approach of how to regain it. Tachbulos Lebal Yipol Chas Shom Avon, that he shouldn't fall and decline to the very pit. Uma also, what did he do? Nishar Melech al Maklo, he retained his dignity and his royalty and his regal demeanor and his regal bearings and trappings and his aristocratic behavior over his staff. He had nothing else, just the staff. He retained his regal royal behavior even in his poverty. And this stood him by in good stead, because he regained his throne, and he regained his empire. It was the beginning of his rise as well. With this insight, we could understand another episode. Again, he's using this theme and explaining many episodes. We could understand the next one. The famous encounter between Yaakov and the angel, where they wrestled and struggled all night long. And we know that Yaakov Avinu was victorious, he emerged victorious, except for one thing. The angel found a way to dislocate his thigh. And that's where Yaakov was weakened, and that's where he was injured, and that's where he became disabled. Now, when he says here, just another side point, perhaps the two go together. Yaakov remained alone. Loneliness is really the entry to the Satan. So maybe the proximity of the two parts of the verse, Vayeivoser Yaakov levado, Vayeovek ish imo. Yaakov's alone, loneliness and being forlorn. That's where the Satan comes to struggle and to fight with you. So he points out, yes, it's good to be alone. It's good to sometimes go off in his bodiless and contemplation, meditation. Meditation and contemplation alone is a wonderful tool for spirituality. But recognize always that meditation and his bodiless, being alone, is also a great danger. It's a danger of the Satan coming and fighting with you. And by Yaakov being levado, alone, by Yehovah Kishimo, that's when the struggle begins. But the pasuk goes on and says, Vayar kilo yocholo, the Satan couldn't get in. Vayigab bekaf yerecho, so he decided to dislocate his thigh. What does that mean? The angel saw that I'm not going to win Yaakov. At least let me dislocate his thigh. I mean, what exactly was going on there? They're fighting and fighting, and the angel says, Yaakov is too powerful, too strong for me. I'll dislocate his thigh instead. What does that mean? Says the Sforno, a very interesting pshat. What does it mean, the thigh, or in this case, the hip? What it's referring to over here is, Vayar kilo yocholo, that Yaakov, that the angel saw he didn't have an in with Yaakov. Why? May Rav de Vekuso Bekel Yisbrach, says the Sforno, because Yaakov was so involved in a kind of a meditative Devekus attachment to Hashem, the Machshavo Bedibu, that he couldn't get an entry in to dislodge Yaakov's mind from God even for an instant. Therefore, why he got the kafir, what does it mean? He touched his thigh. He showed Yaakov the future leaders of the Jews and what kind of misleaders they are. Believe me, we talked about this over the past few weeks, what it means to be a Jewish leader that misleads the people. Yaakov, according to the Medrash, according to Sforno rather, was shown the future misleaders of his people. And when Yaakov became anxious about that and concerned and worried about that, even depressed, and through his anxiety over that, he momentarily let go of his attachment to Hashem, Vatoka Kaf Yerach Yaakov, and that's what brought about the angel's entry into Yaakov's, turn the page, to Yaakov's thing. Sign the page. What? Af Yaakov Avinu, says Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz, Mikivin Shiroa, Haman Higim Asidim Lachto Nofel Rucho Bekirbo. This is what depressed Yaakov Avinu. Umiyad Nitno Shlito Lesotin Lugo Bekach Yerecho. And that became the entry into Yaakov. Va'afo Pishatzar Hoy Mid Kovet Shemaim. True, Yaakov was motivated, obviously, by lofty thoughts and concerns. Nevertheless, the danger of depression is so great that it even affected Yaakov, especially the suddenness of this particular anxiety. Kimin Shenivel Nistakin, he's now in danger. Therefore, we'll skip the rest. So what we see from this is that the danger of a decline and a depression and its momentum, like a stock market, like a general economic depression, the feelings of defeatism is so dangerous to Jewish people as a whole and to an individual that it could lead you, we gave you three examples, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shfichas Damim, the three cardinal sins. What brought them about? According to this understanding, depression. Avodah Zarah, the eagle. Shvichas Domim, Kain and Hevel. Gilui Arayos, Orpa. Three examples of how a person who's almost there, but not quite, and loses it, begins a decline that they can't stop that decline. Klal Yisrael now, I just read you from that article, and I'm telling you it was in today's Jerusalem Post. Oh yeah, whatever. About, let's give up, let's surrender. They're stronger than us. They're willing to fight for their cause more than us. It began with the retreat from Lebanon, which everybody heralded as a wonderful thing. But it wasn't just a retreat. It wasn't an organized retreat. It wasn't like Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says, you're down, the matzav is different. You could reanalyze the matzav, but you regroup, you retrench, you reorganize. Shlomo Melech loses his kingdom. He loses it all. But by the end, he's still a Melech. Fine. He looks around, he has nothing. I'm still a Melech. I still have my dignity. I still have my aristocratic demeanor. I still have my royalty. I still have my regal bearing. I'm still a Melech, although it's over my staff. You regroup. You retrench. You don't run in a panic. If you run in a panic and you retreat, you could give up everything and you don't know how far it goes. And it began in the retreat with Lebanon in the panic. And now, as I read you, there's this air of defeatism in Israel. It's a sakona. We have to be very careful to sakona. I said in the beginning that we're going to learn about the eagle and apply it to today. But we're not going to go through the philosophy of the sin of the eagle or the mystical aspects of it that the Ramban and the Rishonim talk about. We're going to go through the psychology of the chaito eagle. The philosophy of the eagle maybe doesn't apply nowadays. But I said anyway, all philosophies, all ideologies come and go and are usually justifications and rationalizations after the fact for whatever people want. What makes people tick doesn't change. The psychology of people doesn't change. The philosophies change. The ideologies change. All of these things change. The psychology doesn't change. The same thing that makes people in those days fall makes people nowadays fall. The same psychological components are always there. Let's understand the psychology behind the sin of the eagle. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz attributes it to his approach, his psychological approach, is depression and momentum. Both things. Depression, melancholy, and the momentum of fall. That those are shortcut ways for the Yetzer Hara to short-circuit everything. And this fundamental, these dynamics, these forces of psychological nature are true today as well as they always were true. And therefore we are in danger and we have to understand, as he suggests, reevaluate yourself. You're always going to rise, you're always going to fall. But apply the brakes. If you don't apply the brakes in the beginning, then the brakes will fail and the momentum that builds up, that acceleration, will carry you much further than the fundamentals that are there. You analyze a stock, that's what you do. You look at the fundamentals and you say they're there, so why is the stock depressed? Because of the general depression. People are depressed and the stock market depresses, and it falls much further than the fundamentals that are there should indicate. So you know it's a good buy. Again, you have to wait for the market forces and the psychology to turn around, but the fundamentals are there. In terms of a person himself, you have to analyze yourself like a stock. You have to analyze yourself like a stock.